Good afternoon. It is a Thursday, January the 4th, 2018. I got it right today. I didn't say 17. 16 minutes past 12 o'clock. Scott Spears along with you for the ride today on the Now program. Want to take care of a little bit of housekeeping here. Starting tomorrow and each and every Friday on WWGH Radio, we have a new program. 11:10 a.m. is the start time. It is the Protector Show with Ed Johnston. Adam Lepp will co-host and produce this program. It's a show about online safety. Starting tomorrow morning, each and every Friday morning, The Protector Show, 11:10 a.m. with Ed Johnston. And coming up next hour, we're going to be joined by legendary comedian Shecky Green. We had him on during Christmas, and he is just so funny, and it got such a good reaction, we've invited Shecky back next hour to give his take on the world, which is certainly an interesting take. Now, this hour is a little bit of a makeup from last week when I was struck down with the flu, which is not hard to believe when we have had, well, let's say days of zero and sub-zero temperatures since before Christmas Day, really the week of Christmas. But back up and running, and so glad to welcome this gentleman to our microphones. He's always a lot of fun. And when you want to know what's going on in the world, you go to him. Longtime journalist, HBO boxing analyst, Larry Merchant, who's basking in the glow of California where they don't have sub-zero temperatures. Larry, how are you?
I'm good, Scott. We do have mountains, and we do get sub-zero temperatures, but I'm here in Southern California where I found out recently in a quick visit to New York that I had become a wuss, that a little bit of snow and a little bit of chill just drove me indoors and almost frightened me.
How did it end up that you made California your home?
Well, I did quite a lot of traveling in my career as a journalist, and as is usually the case, I suppose, I came to California because of romance, shirt by shirt, until I had more shirts in California than in New York, and figured that this is where I live and that I was destined to be very close to some place where I didn't have to wear socks the year round.
California, we hear so much lately, and certainly late last year with the fires. What's it been like out there?
Well, it came pretty close to where I live in Santa Monica, just a couple of miles up the hill near the Getty Museum and other local establishments. I had friends who lived up in those hills, and they were concerned. So it nearly invaded the metropolitan area of Los Angeles, but they did a good job of containing it finally. But we don't get much rain these years, and when we do, it just builds up the fires to come. So it's just a part of the landscape. I figure that the seasons in California are the rain, which is rare, the fire, which follows, the mudslides, which follows that, and occasionally we have earthquake season.
You know, for those of us who live in Ohio, who live here on the East Coast, what is it like to go through an earthquake?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite understand that.
Well, what's an earthquake like? Do you have to keep things...
Well, occasionally we get the house shakes. One of those, you know, minor three-point-somethings that had its origins probably out in the desert somewhere. But we lived through a big one in the 90s, and the house shook pretty good, and some furniture and things got trampled. It happened so fast, Scott, that unless you happen to be right in the eye of the earthquake, where there is can be serious damage, and that it's almost incidental until you get up and you look around. And because these things can last for 6 seconds or 15 seconds, and we went down to our main drag or street here, and you know, window panes all over the road, and then you start to hear the stories of people who lived nearby, and maybe their houses weren't as built on ground as solid as ours happened to be. So it's consequential. I don't know how it might scar young people, make them afraid of where they live. Or maybe just show them that there's a little bit of uncertainty in life. But it's part of the price we pay for how extraordinary this land is.
When we see the fires in California, the sub-zero temperatures for a month at a time here on the East Coast, and last winter, we had 70-degree days in December. Global warming, of course, big talk last year. The president, I still think, says he doesn't believe in it. A lot of congressmen still feel that way. What part do you feel it plays, and why is this a political issue?
Well, I think this gets to whether we believe in science and facts, or are we just believe in hope and faith, and in whatever equations could exist out there. I mean, 99% of the scientists say that something is going wrong. We've seen the evidence of it with ice sheets and rising seas and bigger storms. I don't think you can use any one a storm to or phenomenon to say this is global warming, but I think it's pretty obvious when the realtors along the coast have their local governments forbid anybody from mentioning global warming, you know there's something going on, because it may threaten land values. The major storms we had in Texas and elsewhere, where money was everywhere, and floodplains were filled with homes, and now there's an almost $200 billion price tag on it. Is that global warming? I'm not smart enough to know that. I don't know who is, but it seems to me the evidence is pretty clear, but at the same time, people are more worried about paying their car payment and their insurances than they are about global warming, and so they tend to look away and say, well, maybe in 50 or 100 years it will affect us, but not us. Incidentally, I do think there's been a change. I don't think that people are in denial about global warming anymore, fully in denial, but it's transposed to, well, the Earth has had many changes in its climate over the millennia, and this is just one of them, and we'll deal with it as it comes. If we get flooded, then we'll build a higher wall. If we get frozen out, we'll move someplace else. So there's no immediate alarm about it, and that's a part of the problem, I suppose.
An interesting story out of California this week, the legalization of recreational marijuana. Story today that Mike Tyson is opening up a marijuana ranch in California.
Can't you see him out there digging in the soil?
Wait, is this a good or bad thing for California? Certainly good for the economy, I would think.
It will be good for the economy. There will be clashes with the federal government, which hasn't agreed that it should be legal. I'm a little concerned. I think there are a price to pay. You're supposed to be 21 in order to afford it. You're not supposed to be able to smoke in public places. There are some restrictions. It alarms me that you can put marijuana in candy and sell it. I once had an incident at a Hollywood party in which they had put it in cakes and cookies and not told people. And people were passing out and falling into the pool. So there's a price to pay, but people who want to use marijuana or other substances have found a way to use it. There's no real argument that it has a greater impact than, say, alcohol. And, of course, it will... It just means that instead of illegal people making a profit, the legal and people and the state will profit, and it's a pretty good experiment in what happens when this becomes legal and public.
Why is it that this particular drug has been argued for more than 30 years now? Nicotine, alcohol, other than prohibition, restrictions, but legal. But marijuana, back and forth, medical, recreational. Why is there such a fight about that particular drug?
Well, we had the drug era, the 60s and the 70s, and it caused some damage as well as gave people some freedom to do as they please individually. And there's always been a kind of mystique, I think, about marijuana. People in the entertainment business using it... people who felt somehow restricted when they had marijuana that opened them up. It loosened people up, and I think it's at the same time it scared people who were concerned about drugs themselves and whether it was just leading to something a lot more serious. I might tell you that a step-granddaughter of mine is in her early 30s and has a 3-year-old son and is a widow because her husband was caught in the opiate crisis and died. It's hard to sometimes separate these things and know what the truth is of where it's going. And it affects a lot of people in a lot of different ways. And the question is whether or not these things are so serious that we have to try to outlaw them, or whether regulating and them makes more sense.
You know, Larry, I'm glad you bring that up, because this is where I get confused. Because opiates in any state are not legal without a prescription. Now, people can abuse prescriptions, or people can steal opioids, but that's not where the majority of the problem is. The majority of the problem is prescribed opiates. Now, if opiates are prescribed by a doctor, the doctors must feel they have some use as painkillers. And then we look at marijuana, which now recreational, it's my understanding, you don't need a prescription. You can take as much as you want, like cigarettes, tobacco, pipes, whatever they do. So could recreation, I've always understood medical marijuana, but if you can take as much as you want for any reason you want, doesn't even have to be a medical reason, could this be a problem? And
well,
why?
I think that Colorado has had legal marijuana for a few years, and they've had, it's been a good test to see whether or not it would be abused. And there have been abuses, just as there are with alcohol. We tried to remove alcohol from the scene, and you saw how that worked. And this is part of that, of a new generational thing, for whom a puff or two was like having a shot or two. And do you try to regulate it, or do you spend a lot of time and energy in the futile attempt to outlaw it?
Well, it's interesting, because Ohio, one of the distinctions that we're not proud of, is being, I believe, the number one state in opioid death. But it's strange, because we sue the opioid company, but again, the doctor has to prescribe the medicine.
Yeah, I'm a little, you know, I've read stuff about the opioid crisis. The New York Times recently had a full section about it. And I'm just not sure what it's all about. Frustration with life in general, the pain of not being able to afford a comfortable middle-class life. And I'm just not sure how opioids play into that, and whether it's just some kind of manufactured relief from the pressures of our world. You would know more about it than I do, and I'm not sure why doctors are prescribing it so often. What are these people who come in? Is it physical pain? Is it emotional pain? Is it just mere frustration? I don't know. The young man I mentioned before actually came from the family of very, very wealthy people, with all the resources, and all his family were all college graduates and so forth. I had no idea that the opioid crisis even reached into that sliver of our world.
It's a peculiar thing, because the doctor would say, if somebody comes into the emergency room after 5 o'clock on a Friday and they have a toothache, I can give them something for pain until they see the dentist, which isn't going to be open till the following week, and who's to say they're going to get an appointment right away. So I give them a prescription so they're not in pain. And this is where the addiction happens. But what's the alternative? You don't give them any pain medicine and they writhe in pain all weekend, which is...
Yeah, but you know, it's become such a widespread problem that there has to be something else under the surface that is causing us to self-medicate almost like that. Look, doctors aren't evil people. They may be businessmen as well as medical men or women, but why are they so eager to do this when the results are so deadly? It just seems odd to me that, I take a couple of Tylenol when I have a headache. I'm not looking to get high and happy. Maybe it's just I'm old and I just don't get why painkillers are so universally used and abused.
I don't know. It's got to be tied some way to emotional distress, because I just can't imagine there's that much physical pain.
Well, I think that everybody is encouraged to dream in America, to achieve. And when things go wrong or they don't go right, some people search for relief from their own disappointments, their own inner pain that can become manifest in physical pain, and maybe that's just been a part of the economic changes that have happened over the last generation.
And going to the political realm, President Trump has been there almost a year now. When you look back at his first year, what do you think? How do you think he's done?
Well, my recollection is when we once talked about this during the election, I think, as I said, that running a country is not like running, or a government is not like running a company. And I think we've seen that. And I just keep telling friends that I hope I would live long enough to see the tell-all, to read all the tell-all books by all the people around the president. And lo and behold, in the last 24 hours, we've got the first one with Steve Bannon. And there's I guess it just confirms the general belief that he may be smart, but he's not wise, and he wallows in his own semi-literacy. So I think it is what it is. He's helped a lot of comedians revive their careers. He's helped cable news revive their numbers. But it does seem a potentially dangerous time. To have a guy who may be smart in the transactional world run a government. Suddenly, once upon a time, we were the light of the world and where everybody wanted to be because it was so great and so free. And from all reports, you know, suddenly around the globe, they see that we have warts.
Yesterday was kind of an interesting day. The president of North Korea, Kim Jong-un, this is not word for word, but basically tweeted that he keeps his button on his desk all the time, and President Trump responded he had a bigger button. And is that normal presidential stuff? No. Should we?
Well, of course not. And you know, one of the miracles of having lived so long is that I actually recall reading in the papers about the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.